Part 3. American Warlords. We were not going to accomplish anything by getting money to the Russians that was going to get lost in some Swiss bank account or funneled into some oligarch's business. Larry Summers, on why the U.S. didn't issue a Marshall Plan for Russia in the aftermath of the Soviet Union's implosion. Chapter 10. Not a Gambino. Real estate was so perfect, it might have been built to launder. Tom Burgess. In the late 2000s, in the years before social media exploded around the world, a user on a website called YouTube uploaded a video that introduced the world to a city few had actually visited, Cleveland, located along the northern rim of Ohio. This hastily made Cleveland tourism video stood as one of the first of what would be known as viral videos, racking up millions of views and introducing untold users to the phenomenon. And it's not hard to see why. The video, crafted by a local comedian who claimed he'd received $14 million from the Cleveland Tourism Board for his efforts, features 50 seconds of shaky, handheld camera footage. The video's color palette ranges from a musty gray to a dirty brown, with all the footage captured under overcast skies. "Fun times in Cleveland today," the narrator sings, flipping between shots of empty public squares, decaying stadiums, and startled pigeons. One shot in the video centers on an open bridge with a half dozen unused silos behind. "Here's the place where there used to be industry," the narrator warbles. Another clip follows a train past an empty concrete plane. "This train is carrying jobs out of Cleveland." Another traces a pair of scruffy men wandering aimlessly. Cleveland leads the nation in drifters. As the video racked up millions of views, a sequel popped up, claiming to be another Cleveland tourism video. This second video featured shots of seagulls and payphones, broken windows and sagging signs, dead fish and slate-gray clouds. Clips of stalled building projects, under construction since 1868, near the gooped-up Cuyahoga River, CR River that catches on fire, and more aimless bodies and empty storefronts and treeless concrete. Our main export is crippling depression. A place where you could, as the narrator shares excitedly, buy a house for the price of a VCR. This, then, was Cleveland in the late 2000s. While American cities elsewhere transformed themselves into new magnets for new migrants, Cleveland watched its residents uproot for other, more promising places. Once a boomtown of American industry, the city's population decline began a few decades prior, when the country's industrial heartland began emptying out in earnest. But the death spiral didn't begin until the 2000s. Capped by a Great Recession, Cleveland, its dying downtown, its abandoned industry, saw a population that by 2010 was less than half of the city's peak nearly a century earlier and continuing to decline. And then, as we saw in Chapter 4, a man from Miami arrived, a man with a jet black beard and money to burn, a man who couldn't have been more than 25 and didn't quite seem to know what he was doing, but who said something about family money, or was it connected to gas wells? And who said that he wanted to help get Cleveland back up on its feet. A man named Chaim Shokat, who said he saw something that few, if any, in Cleveland did. Promise. Or, to steal a term from a certain new president in the White House, hope. As one city councilman would later say of Shokat's arrival, it was like bringing water to a very thirsty person. When Shokat arrived in Cleveland in 2008, Optima, the American arm of Ihor Kolomoisky's sprawling international portfolio, fueled by the Ukrainian oligarch's swelling banking and ferroalloy holdings in Ukraine, was still a lean operation. Led by Mordecai Korf, Kolomoisky's American branch had picked up a number of metal mills across forgotten pockets of the Rust Belt, in Michigan, in Ohio, and West Virginia. As one press release read, they saw the potential of the region. But Korf, connected directly to the Ukrainian oligarch, dreamed bigger. If Kolomoisky really wanted to work his way into the American market, if he really wanted to exploit that rampant American anonymity we've already seen and conceal nine-figure purchases behind webs of Delaware shell companies and purchases that no city officials would question, Optima would have to adjust its strategies. American real estate still worked for massive money laundering operations, but Tay Doran-style mansions, Playboy pads, and beachfront sprawls in places like Miami or Malibu would never work for someone like Kolomoisky, busy as he was looking for ways to hide his assets from nosy Ukrainian investigators and tax authorities. They'd catch too much attention. What about something else? What about, say, commercial real estate, nondescript office buildings and the like? And what if, instead of flashy cities like New York or Miami, these buildings were located in a city or an area that no one would associate with the global uber-rich? Enter Cleveland, Ohio. Shokit immediately jumped at the idea. He could visit Cleveland. He could make the contacts. He could scout the locations. He could make those purchases. He could bundle, conceal, and inject that tainted Ukrainian money directly into the heart of the city. Shokit, as we saw in Chapter 4, made an immediate impression. And not just because of the money he said he could move. The 22-year-old was skittish, fidgety, prone to colorful outbursts, a far cry from the dour, reserved world of real estate management. "He's one of those people who just love to make a statement," said David Browning, managing director of one of Cleveland's main brokerage offices. "Maybe it's an outrageous statement, and he throws it out in a conversation in order to get a reaction. That's part of his style." But still, Shokit said the right things. "I asked him, 'Why Cleveland? Why now?'" said Deb Janik, who helmed the real estate section of the Greater Cleveland Partnership, a private sector development group. His perspective was that it's a market where acquisition was possible, but also it was really his description of the city. He loves the historic nature of the buildings, the density of the city. Where others saw decrepit office space and empty windows, where others saw trains that took jobs out of the city and crippling depression as the main export, Shokit claimed to see something different. He has an eye for taking things that people don't necessarily see as desirable and doing something with them, said Mark Vogel, a local investment banker. It was something more art than business. Vogel was so taken with Shokit's promise that he later attended the latter's wedding in Brooklyn. "It's refreshing to have someone so active in Cleveland," Vogel continued. "I can tell you that he's a person who cares about the city of Cleveland and wants it to do well." When he arrived in Cleveland, Shokit also put on a bit of an air, playing up his New York connections. "I laughed when I saw Cleveland's downtown was three blocks," he told one reporter. "Your entire downtown would be like Midtown in New York." According to those who dealt with Shokit, the stories about the sources of the money he suddenly flushed into Cleveland consistently rotated. To some people, he tied the money to his parents. To others, he claimed some vague connection to post-Soviet gas extraction. "A family connection helped me to get initial consideration in the real estate industry," he said at one point. "But I'm on my own here, and I alone, am accountable to our investors for my decisions and my work." On at least one occasion, he let slip that the funds linked back to Privatbank, a clear clue for anyone interested that the money was tied directly to a Ukrainian oligarch growing in notoriety. But no one, it seemed, paid much attention. No one wanted to look too far into Shokit's financing, descending on Cleveland like manna from heaven. "He loves to get out into the market, walk through other buildings, meet people," said Brian Hertuck, another Cleveland broker. "You wouldn't necessarily see Keim at a huge real estate event, but if you talk to him and you rattle off names of other owners in town, other developers, key attorneys, he's pretty much made the rounds." Still, it's worth noting that not everyone in Cleveland was immediately taken with Shokit's talk, with Shokit's claims of adoring the city, or with Shokit's supposed dreams of what Cleveland could be. Something about him remained off, something odd. It became pretty obvious that something was not completely right, one Cleveland broker familiar with Shokit and his network told me. "I'm not a Gambino, but this wasn't Real Estate 101. Something doesn't add up here. Something in the numbers, and the plans, and the promise that Shokit claimed to see." As the broker said, to be frank, it looked like money laundering. But Shokit claimed he would help shower hundreds of millions of dollars on Cleveland and invest in a place few others thought worth their time, a place that no one would suspect could be a new center of transnational money laundering operations. And, for the city, that was enough. As the local journalist who asked to speak on background said, Shokit simply showed up in Cleveland and started buying when no one else was buying, beginning what would become, according to analysts and authorities alike, the greatest money laundering scheme the U.S. had ever seen. In order to begin plowing Kolomoisky's money into Cleveland, Shokit and the Optima team had to identify potential candidates for purchase. The first building that caught Shokit's eye was a chisel-shaped behemoth called One Cleveland Center, built in 1983. Standing smack in the middle of downtown, flanked by a Dunkin' Donuts and a takeout pub, the office space soars over 30 stories high and houses over 500,000 square feet. As one of the downtown's most architecturally distinct buildings, if you squint just right, the construct resembles a large, aluminum-sided razor, the building was the perfect way for Shokit to announce his arrival. At the time, the building still retained a high tenancy rate, according to one of the brokers who eventually worked with Shokit. The office space within One Cleveland Center was nearly 90% full when the Optima team swooped in. But given the broader economic trajectories and the steady outflow of tenants from other office buildings, the building's prospects weren't especially bright, which is why Shokit's offer stunned locals. $86.3 million, nearly a third more than the building had sold for just a few years prior. All you had to do was wait a little to get a bargain, said one local familiar with the operations. But he didn't wait. The locals involved in the sale would have been fools to decline. All of a sudden, with this single purchase, Optima had arrived in Cleveland, and Shokit now had a reputation, one that would eventually see the Cleveland plain dealer describe him as confident, as an aggressive, quick-thinking dealmaker who had built a downtown Cleveland empire. It's unclear how Korf reacted when he heard the news in Miami that this scruffy, wayward 20-something his sister had married for some reason could, despite the doubts, actually pull this deal together, that it actually worked. If Shokit and Korf and Kolomoisky could snatch a building like One Cleveland Center, a staple of the Cleveland skyline, slicing the air off Lake Erie, why not see what else they could grab? Four blocks east, another office building beckoned. Known as 55 Public Square and squatting over downtown's eponymous plaza for a half century, the building housed 420,000 square feet. At one point Cleveland's tallest building, 55 Public Square hosted a number of white shoe law firms, given the building's proximity to local courthouses, and it was now on the market. As the deal on One Cleveland Center closed, Shokit began conversations with the brokerage firm selling 55 Public Square. The building stood smaller than the One Cleveland Center Colossus and was significantly older, which is why it was valued at only $26 or $27 million. But just to be safe, Shokit had a different number in mind. Would, say, $34 million be enough? And would it be okay if, instead of roping in a mortgage or setting up some kind of third-party financing arrangement, he paid cash? The building goes on the market to sell, and the next thing I know, Kaim shows up, and he doesn't do any due diligence, one of the brokers, who asked to speak on background to discuss the deal, told me. The broker, working for a New York-based firm, called his Manhattan headquarters to run the offer past them. I call New York and they ask, can you do some background on this guy? After all, who shows up and offers eight-figure payments in a spiraling recession in a decaying city for an office building, let alone millions more than the amount for which it's appraised? But Shokit appeared clean. I couldn't find anything, the broker continued, sheepish a dozen years after the deal closed. But he wanted to buy the building cash, $7 or $8 million over the appraisal. There was no reason for anyone to think twice. I say sure, I'll walk to New York to make this deal happen, the broker laughed. Eyes opened after Shokit's first purchase. Heads now turned with news of the second one. The chattering classes in Cleveland suddenly had a single name on their lips, Shokit. But the 20-something wasn't done yet. He'd pocketed two of Cleveland's downtown staples, but more stood there, ready to be plucked, ready to be placed in his and Kolomoisky's portfolio. There was the Huntington Building, which we met in the prologue, running some 1.3 million square feet, described by the Cleveland Plain Dealer as one of downtown Cleveland's largest and most prominent office buildings. Shokit's price, $18.5 million. There was the Penton Media Building, another 500,000 square foot heavyweight, kitty corner from One Cleveland Center. It's a way to cover the whole downtown market, one of Shokit's colleagues said, giving Optima another arrow in our quiver. Shokit's price, $46.5 million. And there was the Crown Plaza Building, a 472-room hotel conference center, the second largest hotel in the entire city, with another 20,000 feet of meeting space, some of which had previously housed the moribund Lehman Brothers. I don't believe there will be another downtown hotel that will mirror our hotel in terms of its luxury, Shokat said at the time. His price? $9 million. That final investment, finalized in October 2011, was a bit different and is worth pausing on momentarily for a brief detour into another tendril of American kleptocracy. To finalize the deal, Shokat broached a joint venture loan with a local investment outfit called the Cleveland International Fund, overseen by an Iranian immigrant named Eddie Zai. It's unclear why he set up this joint venture, but Zai raised his end of the funds by shopping so-called golden visa schemes to foreign nationals from places like China and Brazil, a type of scheme that has, with few paying attention, transformed into one of the key overlooked elements of modern kleptocracy. These golden visas, marketed in the U.S. as the EB-5 visa program, allow deep-pocketed figures abroad to shell out a nominal fee, usually around $1 million, to the U.S. government, alongside a pledge to initiate a jobs creation program in the U.S., all in return for American residency and an eventual path to American citizenship. The program allows oligarchs and kleptocrats to effectively buy American citizenship, regardless of the source of their income. These American golden visas are little different than so-called golden passport programs in places like Cyprus and Malta, which have proven magnets for a world of dirty money, most especially out of corrupt hives like Beijing and Moscow. Yet the American version has received little attention and little criticism. This despite the fact that the program, which has been dominated by wealthy Chinese oligarchs, has been linked multiple times to schemes of large-scale money laundering and bank fraud. Almost nothing is known about the backgrounds of applicants for the EB-5 program, analyst Belinda Lee wrote. The only information made available to American immigration officials is provided by applicants themselves on their application forms. Embarrassingly, many of the forms remain handwritten, with no digital copies existing. Trying to find a criminal hand behind the EB-5 applications, or to sniff out the dirty money behind the applicants, is like trying to find a needle in a haystack, but without knowing which haystack to even look in. All of which is to say, while the reasons for Shokat's partnership with Zai remain unclear, getting to know a man like Zai, who could help foreign oligarchs scheme their way to American citizenship, would be a wise move for a kleptocrat looking to slide into the U.S. Through Shokat, Kolomoisky's total portfolio in Cleveland stretched over millions of square feet and into hundreds of millions of dollars, making the oligarch and his crew the largest commercial owners and landlords in this major American city. "I've not seen anything like this before," one local agent involved in the sales said at the time. "They really, really believe in Cleveland." Nor was Kolomoisky's network done. Shokat had, as he said, big-picture plans for the city. Just a few years removed from life as a nobody, Shokat had transformed Optima into the largest holder of real estate in downtown Cleveland, as Shokat's Wikipedia page reads. As the Cleveland Plain Dealer wrote, Shokat was now the most important guy you've never heard of. At least, that's how it appeared on the outside. For those inside, there was a different story. A select few got to step behind the funhouse mirror to see what was actually happening. They were the first, call it, out-of-town money for Cleveland that came in, one American familiar with their operations said. But from the start of it, it was questionable. There was a lot of shady stuff. Much of that, of course, had to do with the fact that Shokat appeared to have no idea what he was doing. Not bothering to run any inspections, overpaying time and again for buildings that held little promise. But much of that had to do with the method of payment. According to both American officials and those familiar with their operations, one of Shokat's and Optima's preferred payment methods was straightforward. Cash, made out via personal check. No banks, no mortgage lenders, no third-party financiers. Just a checkbook and a PIN, and a final number that, in most cases, stood millions of dollars more than the building's estimated value. With a bank as a lender, you have multiple options down the line, about payment structures, about refinancing, about handling a potential recession, if your financial circumstances change. Then again, with a bank's involvement, the lenders are going to spend weeks, and potentially longer, negotiating the sale, poking through all the financing and figures. But when it came to Shokat and Optima, they just wanted the buildings. That was all that mattered, according to those who saw the operations from the inside. Still, if Shokit wanted to overpay for the buildings he didn't even bother to inspect, no one would force him to do otherwise. After all, his checks cleared. So Shokit began touring the entire region, pocketing entire cities and towns on behalf of a Ukrainian oligarch no one in America had ever heard of. It wasn't only Cleveland. Kolomoisky's Optima Group also picked up steel mills and related plants, lifebloods of entire towns and entire regions in places like Warren, Ohio, Buffalo, New York, Griffith, Indiana, Ashland and Calvert City, Kentucky, Cicero, Illinois, Gibraltar, Michigan, and La Tarte, West Virginia, with the combined sales price stretching into the hundreds of millions of dollars. They'd started dropping their money in new metro markets as well, picking up an office park in Dallas and an office tower in Louisville. The combined price tag for those two properties alone? $124 million. Everywhere they went, Shokit and Optima reportedly said the same things. They were bringing jobs and dreams, renovations and revitalization. The world may have forgotten the American Rust Belt, may have overlooked these towns and these mills and these beating iron valleys, but not Shokit, not Optima. It was the same spiel Shokit unfurled when he drove to a place called Harvard, Illinois, a speck of a town equidistant from Chicago and Milwaukee in the American Midwest. Like the other towns in the region, Harvard's best days were behind it. But in the late 1990s, thanks to a couple of well-placed connections, the chairman of the massive Motorola telecom company made a surprise announcement. The telecom giant would be placing a new manufacturing plant in Harvard. Construction soon began on what would become the largest building not just in Harvard, but the entire region, a 1.5 million square foot facility sprawling over 320 acres, part office and part plant, shaped like a giant wishbone. "It's a huge, huge building," one local, Ed Salise, said. "It looks like a small university." With a $100 million price tag, Motorola announced it would require a staggering 5,000 employees to operate, to help craft the next generation of Motorola phones and lead the global telecom market into the 21st century. "Physically, it's overwhelming to the town," Charlie Eldridge, head of the local Harvard Economic Development Corporation, told me, adding that Motorola and local construction groups immediately began building a half dozen new subdivisions to house all the projected workers. It might be tough to remember now, but at the time, no one surpassed Motorola in the world of mobile phones. The original mobile operator, Motorola set the precedent that behemoths like Apple and Samsung would eventually follow. And there was no reason to think Motorola couldn't retain that leading position at the turn of the 21st century, especially given that it was confident enough to make a $100 million investment in an American farming town few could find on a map. But then, as the construction finished in Harvard, Motorola looked up and realized all of its competitors had passed it by. Motorola thought it could remain analog in an increasingly digital world. Customers, though, thought otherwise. In a matter of just a few years, the bottom fell out of Motorola's business model. And suddenly, the building in Harvard had no purpose. It would never be the cell phone plant originally envisioned. Rather than a testament to Harvard's future, it was a testament to corporate blinders. And for years, it sat, like a beached whale, waiting. Then Shokit showed up. Pulling the same move he'd perfected in Cleveland, Shokit offered $16.75 million for the empty building. A far cry from the Motorola investment, but given the lack of any other real offers, the price tag was more than locals could have hoped for. They happily accepted. Glimmers of potential sprang once more. "Hope burns eternal," Roger Lehman, another member of the Harvard Economic Development Corporation, said at the time. That optimism immediately washed over Harvard, all centered on a building that had long been vacant, a lifeblood that had long sat empty. "It's been sitting there for so long," Solis added, "it's like the building is cursed." Chapter 11. The Wild West. The Greeks knew that democracy is not likely to fall to the charms of totalitarianism, authoritarianism, or oligarchy. It's much more likely to fall to a corrupted version of itself. Tony Judd. While Kolomoisky was building his empire in the U.S., Ukraine began falling to pieces. In the mid-2000s, a roster of pro-Western figures had come to power in Kyiv, promising an end to the elite-level corruption that cannibalized the country's wealth, whisking it out of the country in the process. By the end of the decade, though, the reformers were exhausted, frustrated, fractured. As a result, in the 2010 presidential election, Ukrainians backed an opposition figure named Viktor Yanukovych, a man whom they'd ousted via revolution just a few years prior, but who now promised a different path forward. To those who knew him, Yanukovych was little more than a brute, an imbecile, an unreconstructed Soviet who viewed Russia's neighboring dictatorship with envy. But in those post-Great Recession days, Yanukovych had an ace up his sleeve, an American named Paul Manafort, a man with the gift of turning any would-be autocrat into someone who could actually win an election. Hired by Yanukovych and his team to improve the strongman's image, Manafort crafted a campaign to spin Yanukovych as warm and welcoming, as a font of competence in these incompetent times. Thanks in no small part to Manafort's efforts, Yanukovych won the 2010 presidential election. But it didn't take long for Yanukovych's facade to fall apart. In November 2013, after months of pressure from Moscow, Yanukovych, with his cronies busy looting state coffers, abruptly pulled Ukraine back from negotiations with the European Union. Perturbed by the decision, protesters waving the blue and yellow flags of Ukraine and the EU alike gathered in Kyiv's downtown square, known as the Maidan. Slowly, the protesters gathered steam, even in the face of Yanukovych's thuggish security services. Tensions soon spiraled, and in February 2014, Yanukovych's forces opened fire, with snipers raining bullets over the unarmed protesters, resulting in dozens of deaths. Realizing the murders had only galvanized the protesters, the autocrat tucked tail and fled to Russia. In hindsight, it was likely the right move for Yanukovych. Shortly after his ouster, journalists flocked to his megamansion outside Kyiv. In addition to finding everything from ostriches to a golden loaf of bread, as well as nude portraits of Yanukovych himself at the estate, journalists elsewhere discovered a range of documents pointing directly to Yanukovych's financial malfeasance. Documents about offshore payments, documents about secret ledgers, documents about certain Americans, like Manafort, with whom the public would soon become intimately familiar. But we'll come back to those documents later, because it's in those heady post-revolution days that we rejoin our story of Kolomoisky and American kleptocracy. As Ukraine teetered in the days following Yanukovych's ouster, the Kremlin began barreling into southern Ukraine, claiming Crimea as an area that had always been Russian, and repressing the indigenous Tatar populations who highlighted that falsehood. From there, Russia began flooding swaths of eastern Ukraine, beginning the process of wresting provinces known as Luhansk and Donetsk. Ukraine's army quickly disintegrated. Yanukovych, it turned out, had spent the past 3 years selling Kyiv's military for parts, mothballing tanks, and stripping entire regiments. Crimea was already gone, and just a few weeks later, it appeared that the entirety of eastern Ukraine would follow suit and soon rejoin a revanchist Russia. Which is the point where Kolomoisky re-enters the Ukrainian story, and where he becomes something more than simply a banking and metals oligarch with a strange fetish for sharks. Watching Russian proxies chewing through chunks of eastern Ukraine, Kolomoisky had an idea. What if he bankrolled forces of his own to face down the Russians? What if he funded, organized, and armed thousands of Ukrainian patriots, eager to beat back the rising Russian nationalism rumbling through Dnipro and its neighboring regions? The new government in Kyiv immediately agreed. Appointing Kolomoisky as the interim governor of the entire Dnipro province, they offered him broad writ to organize his own militia. According to one of his aides, Kolomoisky immediately got to work, ponying up tens of millions of dollars to help arm some 15,000 Ukrainian militiamen, sicking his new brigades on the pro-Russian separatists. "We're doing all this in agreement with the central government," one of those aides said. "We coordinate and cooperate with Kyiv, and they accept that we are influential as a consolidating factor in the East." Not that everything centered only on national interests, necessarily. As Boris Filatov, Kolomoisky's deputy, added, the idea was to save the country and save his assets at the same time. Nor did the oligarch ditch the shark tank. When meeting with new pro-Western officials from Kyiv, he would routinely press a button on his desk to release crayfish meat to his pets, unnerving guests as the water behind him turned bloody. But he played the patriotism card as best he could. calling Putin a schizophrenic of short stature, the Ukrainian oligarch pledged a $10,000 bounty for pro-Russian militants captured with guns. As one of the battalion commanders said, "Russians should come to Dnipro, because here we will kill them." The Russians, though, never made it that far, largely because they and the pro-Russian locals soon bogged down, stopped by a regrouping Ukrainian military and by the thousands of militia forces flocking to Kolomoisky's banner. He took charge and is still seen as this oligarch who was patriotic, who was pro-Ukrainian, who basically saved the Dnipro region from what was happening in Donetsk, one Ukrainian journalist told me. By the end of 2014, a stalemate emerged across a swath of eastern Ukraine, covering far less territory than Putin and his proxies initially wanted. It turned out that Kolomoisky, as the Wall Street Journal dubbed him, had been Ukraine's secret weapon all along. As the oligarch later said in the third person, "A large number of people think Kolomoisky's great, and the only patriot in the country." By early 2015, the oligarch looked to consolidate his gains. He already controlled Ukraine's largest bank and sat at the center of Ukraine's tangled web of gas extraction enterprises. And now he stood as governor of one of the key regions in one of the key countries for Europe's and the West's broader future. But new Ukrainian president Petro Poroshenko, an oligarch himself, looked to clip Kolomoisky's wings. In March, new reforms out of Kyiv undercut Kolomoisky's control of the country's largest oil and gas conglomerate, called Ukrtransnafta, whose chair had been a close Kolomoisky ally. In response, Kolomoisky threw a fit. In a video later posted to YouTube, dozens of men, clad in camouflage and balaclavas, lugging boxes and bags and weaponry, are seen hustling into the company's headquarters under cover of night. They block the entryways, affixing metal grills to the doors, turning back inquiring journalists. One man lets slip the group's affiliation. They were Kolomoisky's militia, come to help their patron. Shortly thereafter, Kolomoisky himself appears, walking to reporters waiting outside, wearing a striped blazer and black t-shirt. The oligarch initially appears calm. But one question about why he was there sends the oligarch spiraling. "Why don't you ask how the corporate raid on Ukrtransnafta happened, and how Russians infiltrated the place? Or you just want to fucking see Kolomoisky," the oligarch spits, referring to himself in the third person. "We liberated the Ukrtransnafta building from Russian saboteurs, and you and your colleagues sit here and fucking guard it, like some bimbo with her cheating husband." The journalist who asked the question stood in stunned silence, while Kolomoisky continued taunting him. "Why aren't you saying anything? Do you have any questions? Or did your tongue get lost in your ass?"
It was a bizarre, addled sight. Ukraine's revolution just a year prior was supposed to have made these moments a thing of the past.
Yet here Kolomoisky was, an oligarch resurgent, steering the country's banking and metal and gas sectors, spitting venom at reporters, sicking his masked marauders on those who opposed him. One Ukrainian journalist told me Kolomoisky has a psychopathic personality. "I think Kolomoisky is super dangerous," an American official, then working in the embassy in Kyiv, said. "He is probably one of the most dangerous oligarchs because he's one of the ones who's willing to get his hands dirty." He was one of the first oligarchs who began to act like a warlord.
Back in the U.S., while Kolomoisky continued building his empire across the Midwest and Rust Belt, folks in Washington continued building on their momentum after toppling Teodorin. Levin and his staff found a new rapport with the new administration in the White House. Buoyed by the Kleptocracy Asset Recovery Initiative, the U.S., under Obama, showed signs of reorienting resources toward fighting and regulating the kinds of kleptocratic tools that helped the crooked regimes hollow out and destabilize countries like Ukraine. A decade after Levin arm-twisted the U.S. banking sector into complying with basic anti-money laundering checks, the wind was suddenly in anti-corruption activist sails. Yet, as we'll see through the rest of this chapter, for each step forward in the fight against dirty money and the offshoring world, there was another clear and unexpected step back. First, the victories. In late 2007, a middle-aged, ginger-haired American named Bradley Birkenfeld approached Levin's staff with a bombshell revelation. He disclosed that he had worked for a number of years at the flagship Swiss bank UBS, and what he saw shocked him. According to Birkenfeld, the Swiss reputation for banking secrecy was well-earned and wasn't viewed as being nearly as nefarious or disgusting as it should be. Birkenfeld unspooled a raft regarding details of UBS's operations that made Levin's staff furious. The former banker told them that UBS specifically targeted high-net-worth American individuals looking to limit their tax payments, keen to take full advantage of Swiss secrecy laws in order to starve Washington of revenue. A formidable force of Swiss employees traveled to the U.S. multiple times per year to target U.S. clients and convince them to hide money abroad. They would go to Miami art shows or to yachting events or to golf and tennis tournaments and whisper about all the services the Swiss could provide for them. Birkenfeld, part of UBS's U.S. operations, participated in these schemes, actively advising American clients about a range of tactics to hide their money from the government, destroy all offshore banking records existing in the United States, use Swiss bank credit cards that they claimed could not be discovered by U.S. authorities, and file false U.S. individual income tax returns. One UBS banker even memorably helped a client move money by smuggling diamonds in a tube of toothpaste. The revelations made Levin's team blanch, but UBS was hardly the lone Swiss bank advising wealthy Americans on how to shortchange the U.S. government. Later investigations revealed that Credit Suisse, another Swiss banking behemoth, went to even greater lengths in its subterfuge, with bankers there actively promising to shred any compromising documents and even slipping clients' confidential banking information hidden between the pages of Sports Illustrated. And wealthy Americans were only too happy to participate. Later filings revealed that Swiss banks maintained over 50,000 secret American accounts, part of the $20 billion in Swiss accounts linked to U.S. clients, billions of dollars untaxed, hidden by Americans exploiting Swiss secrecy. The reaction to Birkenfeld's revelations was swift. 1 month into the new Obama administration, Washington slapped a $780 million penalty against UBS, forcing the formidable Swiss bank to admit that it conspired to defraud the U.S. The move was an earthquake in the offshore world, Elise Bean later wrote. Expressions of shock reverberated around the globe at the first cracks in Swiss secrecy. It was a huge U.S. victory over the world's biggest tax haven bank. Not long after, the administration one-upped itself, forcing Credit Suisse to pay a staggering $2.6 billion in penalties. In short order, the U.S. had cracked open Switzerland's decades-old secret banking sector, upending Switzerland's offshoring industries, sending its suspect money and all of its enablers scrambling. This was the first real nail in the coffin for Swiss banking secrecy in particular, and offshore secrecy in general, Peter Kotter-Chenu, an expert in Swiss financing, wrote afterward. In light of the UBS scandal, the United States became the flag bearer for greater transparency. Nor was that all. In 2010, just a year after pummeling UBS and the entire facade of Swiss secrecy, Congress passed a piece of legislation to follow the administration's lead. Dubbed the Foreign Accounts Tax Compliance Act, FATCA, the new legislation required all foreign banks to report American holdings to the IRS. In order to coax them to obey, the U.S. threatened a 30% withholding tax on non-compliant banks, as well as a pledge to share information with foreign governments about any foreign nationals who may be using American banks to skirt taxes back home. It was a simple enough model, and one other countries were eager to follow. The most prominent FATCA-inspired program was called the Common Reporting Standard, CRS, a blueprint that required signatory countries to share account information with one another. Launched in 2014, the CRS quickly roped in 100 different countries, becoming, in effect, one giant pool of account-sharing information. All of it thanks to Washington. Thanks to a program that, as The Economist wrote, ushered in a global revolution in financial transparency. But even while the administration was applauding itself for the blows to global offshoring and tax dodging, a parallel force gurgled to the fore, threatening to undo much of the progress Washington had already made. South Dakota, a state in the upper Midwest, is a bit like Delaware. Resource poor, often overlooked, the state is something of an afterthought in the U.S., and it's been that way for decades. From the outside, aside from Mount Rushmore, there's little reason to think about South Dakota. But in the 1980s, the state produced a figure who would upend the world of financial secrecy, and who would help transform South Dakota into the newest American bastion of kleptocracy. William Janklow, Wild Bill as others dubbed him, was as much a bon vivant as he was a visionary. The wide-set Janklow was, as The Guardian described him, a bottomless store of anecdotes about how he once brought a rifle to the scene of a hostage crisis, how his car got blown off the road when he was rushing to the scene of a tornado. As a 16-year governor in the state, Janklow swaggered as a titan of prairie politics, perfecting the art of arm-twisting in the tiny state capital, Pierre. Which is why, when South Dakota saw its economy crater in the early 1980s, the entire state turned its eyes to him. The state didn't have the infrastructure to attract new manufacturing plants. Tourism could only bring so many jobs. And given South Dakota's landlocked status, it's not like the state could transform into a new trade hub or become an import-export bastion. Janklow, though, had a plan. A plan that those politicians decades prior in Delaware, a state similarly cursed with few economic opportunities, would have recognized. In 1978, the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled in a little-noticed decision that American banks would no longer have to be limited by low caps on interest rates, which had been kept to a minimum by anti-usury laws stretching back decades, preventing banks and credit companies from charging inordinately high interest rates. The ruling happened to coincide with banks increasingly dipping their toes into something called credit cards, which allowed consumers to borrow on credit so long as they were willing to pay the interest rate charged. With those two developments, Janklow stumbled across an idea. Putting out feelers to the banks in New York, Janklow had a question. What would happen if he got South Dakota to abolish all of these nuisance anti-usury regulations? What if he got the state to allow these banks to issue whatever interest rates they'd like? The banks were all ears. Citibank, in particular, told Janklow that it could provide hundreds of jobs if the governor repealed the interest limits. They weren't sure that any state would let them come in, because no state had let any bank come in from the time they passed those laws 50 years earlier, Janklow later said. To me, this wasn't a credit card deal. It was a jobs deal. It was an economic opportunity for the state. Janklow and Citibank swiftly came to an arrangement. In 1981, Janklow oversaw the repeal of South Dakota's previous interest rate limit, and the repeal was an immediate hit with banks and consumers alike. Interest rates suddenly exploded, as did the concomitant consumer debt that resulted from the higher interest rates. It's unbelievable the lack of sophistication that we have as a society to deal with what I'll call consumer credit, Janklow later said. It really is unbelievable. Do I think I helped foster some of that? The answer is yes, I do. Not that South Dakota minded. To some, South Dakota is a flyover state, one of the state's Supreme Court justices would later say. While many people may find a way to fly over South Dakota, somehow their dollars find a way to land here. But Janklow wasn't done. If it was easy enough to repeal those interest rate ceilings, were there other limits worth repealing? The governor had something in mind. Trusts. Trusts had a far longer legacy than credit cards, or South Dakota, or even the U.S. itself. First developed in the Middle Ages, trusts were simple constructs. A person, the settlor, would hand over legal control of finances and assets to another person, the trustee, who was then charged with managing and distributing the finances and assets for future recipients, the beneficiaries. For instance, a father, the settlor, would sign over the legal ownership of his estate to a friend, the trustee, who would, at an undefined future date, relinquish that legal ownership to the father's grandchildren, the beneficiaries. That's it. Simple. Deceptively so, especially since trusts generally remain secretive, unavailable for public scrutiny. Trusts are powerful mechanisms, journalist Nicholas Shaxson once wrote, usually with no evidence of their existence on public record anywhere. That's how trusts operated for centuries, through the Enlightenment, through the Great Wars, through the ascent of America on the global stage. By the early 1980s, trusts stood broadly similar to their medieval precedents. And then Janklow showed up, and trusts turned into something else entirely. Shortly after Janklow torpedoed interest rate caps, he hit on a new idea. What if South Dakota removed the cap on the chronology of trusts? Trusts generally expired after a century, or a few decades after the death of the settlor, forcing the distribution of any remaining assets. Anything else would have been ludicrous. And yet, that's precisely what Janklow wanted. In 1983, the South Dakota legislature repealed the Rule Against Perpetuities, the regulation that limited the duration of these secretive trusts. In their wake, South Dakota introduced a new tool to the world, perpetual trusts, sometimes called dynasty trusts. These new perpetual trusts, according to the South Dakota legislature, have no end. They can last as long as you want. They can last until South Dakota slips into the sea or until the sun burns from the sky. They can outlast us all and do so in perfect secrecy. Those dynasty trusts, of course, needed lawyers. They needed accountants. They needed managers. They needed white-collar South Dakotans to oversee them and their operations. As with the interest rate repeal, this new perpetual trust industry created thousands more jobs in South Dakota, offering services to anyone who wanted to bundle their finances into a trust and keep it secret in perpetuity. Even though these perpetual trusts initially met with much derision, Janklow didn't exist in a vacuum. Other state governments watched South Dakota's regulatory rollback and tried to get their own piece of the deregulated pie. Following South Dakota's lead, a number of other states by the end of the 20th century had introduced their own perpetual trust industries. Janklow, though, wouldn't let South Dakota's advantage slip. In 1997, with billions starting to flock to the state to take advantage of the secretive perpetual trust industry, Janklow formed a trust task force. Comprising legislators and leading figures in the trust industry, the task force proposed tweaks and reforms that made it seem like the trust industry was writing laws essentially for themselves, said one state legislator. Or as Tom Simmons, an expert on trust law at the University of South Dakota and member of the task force, told me, it's kind of like sports, you know. You have to keep a few points ahead of the other people. And what reforms they were. In South Dakota, not only do trusts remain entirely secret from the public, or from journalists, or tax authorities, or human rights activists trying to track down looted assets, but any court documents pertaining to South Dakota trusts are kept private in perpetuity. No information on South Dakota trusts will ever be shared with other governments, and those looking to hide their funds don't need to move to South Dakota to take advantage of the trusts, or even use any local banks. One trust specialist in the state estimated that nearly all trusts in the state are what I call shell companies, where you basically have a P.O. box or an office, and somebody will come here twice a year to have board meetings and meet regulatory requirements, but there's nobody here with feet on the ground. And now, those hiding their money in South Dakota no longer even need beneficiaries like children or grandchildren. Instead, people can set up South Dakota trusts with themselves as the listed beneficiaries, using the anonymous perpetual trust industry's secrecy as a shield, keeping their finances hidden from any prying eyes. To be sure, there are plenty of perfectly legitimate reasons to set up and maintain trusts. Some are aimed at helping spendthrift descendants limit their expenditures. Some are meant to be spent only on education or to finance the lives of children suffering from disabilities after the parents have died. But what South Dakota introduced was something qualitatively different. Something meant to explicitly create new dynasties, which would never have to participate in silly things like taxation or financial transparency. What South Dakota guaranteed was anonymity from everyone, forever. South Dakota offers the best privacy and asset protection laws in the country, and possibly in the world, for the wealthy to protect their assets, one financial advisor told The Guardian, with another observer saying that South Dakota legislators had turned the Mount Rushmore state into the Bermuda of the prairie. Or as one South Dakota journalist wrote in 2016, forget Switzerland. South Dakota is actually one of the best places in the world for the wealthy to stash their cash in secret. Of course, those profiting from South Dakota's sprint to becoming an offshore haven of its own don't see things this way. We're certainly always worried about the black eye of one nefarious actor, one money laundering or white-collar crime that somehow utilized our trust industry to commit wrongful acts, Simmons, the member of the state's trust task force, claimed. It's not the Wild West, but rather one of the more regulated industries in our country. But then, the Wild West technically had laws and regulations on its books, too. Not that they stopped the railroad barons and white supremacists from bending the laws to their own wills, devastating communities along the way, which is precisely what South Dakota's trust industry has begun doing on a global scale. Starting in the early 2010s, hundreds of billions of dollars in untraceable money began stampeding to the state, with estimates now placing the total worth in these anonymous, unregulated South Dakota trusts at nearly $1 trillion. Ironically enough, much of it rushed in from Switzerland. None are subject to any anti-money laundering requirements or to oversight of any kind, and none are required to ever return any assets to the populations from which they were looted. The voters in South Dakota don't have a clue what this means, Susan Wismer, a local Democratic official, said. They've never seen a feudal society. They don't have a clue what they're enabling. We've only just gotten a peek behind South Dakota's offshore curtain in recent years, though not because of South Dakota itself. Instead, it's been filings elsewhere that have revealed some of the details of South Dakota's supernova explosion into the world's newest offshore haven. Over the past few years, a number of corporate filings in, of all places, China, revealed that a range of Chinese oligarchs have begun smuggling their money into South Dakota. Tens of billions of dollars in suspect Chinese monies have flowed to the state, including billions tied to Chinese real estate developers and billions more tied directly to one of China's wealthiest women. That is, the oligarchs and kleptocrats who've grown wealthy from their ties to the ruling dictatorship in Beijing have effectively partnered with officials in South Dakota to hide their money, to partake in this prairie-based version of American kleptocracy. Back in Miami, Kolomoisky's American helpers wanted to reward themselves for all their hard work in allegedly helping stash the Ukrainian oligarch's funds across the U.S. Mordecai Korf, a man whose father had slaughtered chickens himself and who had raised Korf and his siblings on a shoestring budget, bought for himself a 9-bedroom, 8-bathroom mansion in a posh Miami Beach enclave called Sunset Lake, its walls and columns bleached white, a pool shimmering in the back. The tab? $7.7 million. His compatriot, Uri Leber, moved a few blocks down, snapping up a similar mansion for $14 million. Korf also looked elsewhere to display his new wealth. In 2008, a new foundation received tax-exempt status, the Korf Family Foundation. Overseen by Korf, it's unclear what the mission or even the registered location of the Korf Family Foundation is. However, the foundation, along with the Labor Foundation, set up by Labor, nonetheless became another prong to move significant sums, funneling tens of millions of dollars toward Jewish nonprofits from 2006 to 2018. It's the whole concept of wealthy Jews helping the community, Labor claimed at one point. Let's build something nice. And people noticed. As Forward wrote, Korf and Labor, through their donations, through their status, had come to represent the pinnacle of generosity to many religious Jews in Florida. Of course, no one knew exactly where Korf's money came from, nor was anyone quite sure of his connections to Kolomoisky. I think Kolomoisky is a shareholder, Korf at one point claimed to an inquiring reporter, downplaying a years-long relationship. To those on the outside, it all remained a mystery. But no one, not in Cleveland, not in those small Rust Belt steel towns, not in those nonprofits receiving new millions from Korf himself, wanted to look too far anyway.